Good evening. Tonight, we are going to talk about mindfulness and concentration. These two factors, faculties or powers, they're kind of interchanged when we talk about it in practice. It's almost like the line between mindfulness and concentration gets blurred such that we begin to think it's kind of all the same thing, but it's very distinctly different. But at the same time, they're so interrelated to each other that it's good to talk about them both together. So you can begin to see how one leads into the other and one sort of supports the other. One way I like to think about it, so I used to have a lot of old cars, and old cars, not so much now, the cars now are pretty computerized, but the older cars, you could pretty much fix them yourself. And if you have an old car, like from maybe the, 70s or 80s, you could pretty much every day work on your car, every weekend, and keep it running, even if you had some old beat up car. I know this. So the way I think about mindfulness and concentration is that mindfulness would be like the starter. It's the thing that starts the engine going, but it does not keep the engine going. What keeps the engine going is like an alternator, and that alternator would be concentration. So this mindfulness is what starts our practice into this energy, and then the actual concentration is what keeps it going. But before we get too far into it, I need to back up a minute and explain, kind of get on this alignment, an understanding, how I see the mind now, which is very different than the way I saw the mind about 10 years ago. So when I first started practicing, and for, I'd say, the first 10 or 15 years of my practice, whenever I thought about the mind or heard any Dhamma talks or anything about the mind, I thought of it as that sort of cognizing ability that we have, the thinking process, that part of us that kind of, it's like the brain is the best way to say it. I thought the mind and the brain were the same thing. So whenever we're talking about the mind, we're really talking about the brain and the brain's ability to function. And that in our brains, there's a subconscious and an unconscious, or subconscious, unconscious, and then there's a conscious aspect of the brain. So this is how I saw the mind and any talks related to the mind. But the talk I'm going to talk about tonight is different than that. I just, from practice, I don't see the mind as the brain anymore. And so it's probably important for me to kind of explain a little bit where that is. The mind feels like potential now. It would be pure potential. It is not something. There's no substance to it. There's no thing with it. There's no body, no shape or form or anything like that. It's just potential. It's just possibility. And it exists in stillness. So there's no noise or anything, and peaceful. And somehow or another, we put a lot of ideas, imagery, judgment, form, a lot of opinion on that stillness and create what we call life. So mindfulness, concentration, from the way we're going to talk tonight, is how would we get back to that stillness, that original state of the mind. Hmm. had a really nice quote, but I can't find it. If we were going to try to get past, get back to that state, let me get my head right over here because I can hear it. If we were going to try to get to that state, somehow or another, we would have to get past all this thinking, all this opinion and thought and stuff that's on top of it, all what Rodney always refers to as the noise that's on top of that otherwise still existence. And mindfulness is sort of the way to do that. Buddha said, so we could know kind of what this mindfulness is, that mindfulness is useful everywhere. And for the mind to find refuge in mindfulness, and mindfulness is its protector. Or actually, for the mind finds refuge in mindfulness, and mindfulness is its protector. Mindfulness is the protector of the mind, and the mind finds refuge in mindfulness. Without mindfulness, there can be no exertion and no restraint of the mind. It's like an unruly thing. And we'll talk a little bit about how that happens. So I looked up mindfulness to try to figure out, if we're going to start with mindfulness, what exactly that would be. Because nowadays, mindfulness, when I first started practicing, there wasn't that much discussion about practice. And mindfulness, this idea of mindfulness, wasn't even so quite commonplace. But now it's very commonplace. And so there's all these definitions all over the place about it. What the dictionary says, I always start there, just comes from practice, I guess. Dictionary says, it's a state of being mindful or a practice of maintaining a non-judgmental state of heightened awareness. I cut it off there. There's a little bit more about moment by moment. But that seems like a lot to describe the starter, just the thing that starts us into this practice. Another definition I've read and heard, I think it came from John Kabat-Zinn, but I'm not sure, but it's this moment-to-moment awareness of whatever is arising. So this moment-to-moment awareness. Buddha calls this the mind's protector, where the mind takes refuge in this mindfulness. But the definition that I like is from the Abhidhamma, which is that mindfulness is the act of remembering. It's the act of remembering. And if we think of mind as just the pure potential or the stillness, then mindfulness would be the act of remembering to find its way back to that stillness. It would be the act of remembering its refuge or remembering that place of protection that it can rely on. And so how we would go about connecting to that has a lot to do with why mindfulness in a retreat setting is so much easier to grasp, feel, and keep than it is when we come home. So one way to think of this remembering, this act or this ability that we have to remember, there's a stillness somewhere in this moment. This way of remembering that is that without that remembering, we get lost in forgetfulness, carelessness, distraction. And what we're going to find is that that forgetfulness, that carelessness, that distraction, that kind of unruly way we let the mind just kind of wander is what leads us into much of the difficulty suffering we have. I dare say it probably leads us into all the suffering we have. So if we could remember that there's a stillness somewhere, this coming back to that remembering is what the quality of mindfulness is. If you think back, for those of you that have gone on retreats, or even if you haven't done a retreat, you've done a day of mindfulness, that continuity of remembering is what supports us. So at a retreat, there's this constant container that keeps reminding us to come back. We don't have to remember. The container reminds us, because a lot of the distractions and a lot of the things that we would carelessly, haphazardly do, or forget, you know, forget where we're at, that is kind of taken away, and the container itself is what keeps us present all the time, constantly reminding us. Teachers remind us, the meditation schedule reminds us, the way that even our eating meditation, or it's in silence, the whole container of a retreat practice or a day of mindfulness reminds us to come back to this mindfulness. But then as soon as we go home, I don't know if you notice this, but I notice this. As soon as I go home, yeah, it's all gone. I can remember sometimes, but 90% of my life, I just would not remember to be still or where the stillness is. I would just get so caught up in everything that was going on that it was just moving from one thing to the next thing to the next thing. And about 10 years ago, you know, I had that retreat with these nuns. Things began to change, and I started practicing differently. I wasn't trying to be anything or get anywhere or somehow or another come to some great understanding that if I had this understanding, then I would know I was a practitioner. It just sort of stopped. It changed from that. And instead of practice being about some great moment in time, some understanding or place I was going to eventually get to, it became about one particular moment, and that was the moment I happened to notice that I was in. And that was it. It didn't really matter anything else, it's just a moment I noticed that I was in. Sort of like when we're sitting and you notice you're thinking and then you wake up. It's in that moment that practice exists. And wherever it was before is irrelevant. And whether you can hold it beyond that moment is irrelevant. What becomes relevant is just that moment right there, that moment in time. And what could you do with that moment? So I took what I learned in retreat and begin to notice how that shows up in any given moment. What you could think of as what would be the aspects of an experience, of a moment in time. How would we experience it? And there are four kind of ways that we experience any given moment at any time. The body, so our sensory data, something's coming in from one sense or another. The body's movement, the body's either standing still, it's lying down, you're reaching for something, you're sitting, there's some movement, something happening in the body. You could think of it as some passion exists, some desire or wanting or grasping after, or you're kind of like lost in thought. You're lost somewhere in kind of this discursive kind of thinking. So one of those four qualities is going to show up in any moment, and I started looking for them. I started looking for one of those things. What is it that's happening in the moment when I wake up and I notice I'm doing something? Am I seeing? Am I hearing? Am I touching? What is it? Is something, what is it that's connected to me? Or I started noticing when I woke up, do I have a lot of like pull in this moment? So sometimes you don't even know what's happening. And all of a sudden you wake up to this energy of wanting something and really leaning into it to get it. So I would wake up to that energy, that passion about something. Or I would wake up to myself just kind of like idle chatter in the mind. I would wake up to that. Or just notice that I'm doing something, I'm sitting here. Or notice that I'm moving. That moment in time became my capacity to awaken. The mind awakens on its own. I didn't get it to notice that I all of a sudden am awake and I can remember. But when I started practicing with these awakened moments, I could use those awakened moments to remember that there's stillness somewhere. Does that make sense? I can't wake myself up. I've tried that. I've tried that for 25 years. It's not possible. So those of you that are new in practice, don't bother. Not gonna happen. I would try to figure out a way to be mindful all day. And it just would not happen. But what would happen is every once in a while, I would have this crystal clear awareness in this moment. That just became my little practice piece. Mindfulness is a mirror through, mindfulness is a mirror through. This is something Bhante, This is something Bhante Ji said. Mindfulness is mirror through. It reflects only what is presently happening and exactly the way it is happening. There is no biases. So it's sort of the capacity for you to see what's actually happening. We have all these techniques when it comes to sitting practice on how to see and have mindfulness be that capacity that helps us get to stillness when we're sitting. But when we're walking around and doing our lives, which is what happens to us most of the time, we're not sitting in meditation, we're off the cushion somewhere. Having the ability to remember where stillness is in any given moment becomes the thing that mindfulness offers us. And the reason why I believe it is a spiritual power is because that awakening moment comes on its own. It doesn't have anything to do with us. It's not coming from us. We can't generate that awakening moment. It just happens. It's not the moment that the mind wakes up. It's what we do with it once we see we have woken up. So let's think a little bit about why it's so important to stay sort of with these aspects or this part of experience. I don't know how Buddha saw this. It sort of have to be still, I guess, and then you kind of see that dependent origination, that thing that if this happens, and it's so automatic. It's so automatic that I was trying all day, how could I think of something that would explain this, which is why I kind of use my car example. Because the process from the car starting with the starter and moving to the alternator is so automatic that you can't disrupt it unless the starter doesn't work. You can't really disrupt it. But you can jumpstart your car and get the alternator going, and then it will run just fine. Or you could, if your alternator's not working, I know this, you start your car, and it just sort of runs out. And then as soon as you turn your car off, your car is dead, because there's no kind of juice with it. There's this kind of way that it's so automatic that if we don't begin to notice the automatic flow of it, we get caught. That automatic flow is what makes this all about me, all about us. The mind, something happens with a sense door, something happens with a movement. I think I shared this with some people, I'm not sure all of you know, but I was at this retreat and I had probably one of the best jobs in the retreat for a yogi job. After lunch, before dinner dishes. So the lunch people have already washed all those hundreds of plates. And maybe about an hour or two afterwards, you go into the kitchen, see if there's any dishes. Maybe there's a cup or two, maybe a dish or two. You wash those and that's it. Best job. But every time I would go in, I would be so sad, so melancholy. Weightedness was on this job and I couldn't shake it. I kept trying to figure my way out as to why I would be feeling so much melancholy around this yogi job. So I thought, well, it must be because of my mom, because my mom used to work in a, you know, she was in church and she always had us, all her kids in the kitchen cleaning up the dishes after some big function. And so I thought, oh, it must be because I'm doing dishes and this is something my mom made us do. Nope, melancholy still there, never went away. I tried for at least a couple of weeks to figure out in the mind what it is that was causing this melancholy. I stewed over it, spun over it, talked to my teachers about it. I don't understand. Why is this melancholy here? Why? Melancholy every day you do your yogi job, and every day I would feel the sadness, deep, deep sadness. So one day, finally, I wake up, have this brilliant idea that I'm not going to try to figure out what's happening, but just to be with it, whatever it is. We're just going to go and be with the yogi job and be with whatever's happening. So come time for my yogi job, I'd start walking towards the kitchen and there comes that sadness. And I get into the kitchen and I watch myself turn on the light, feel the light switch, watch it turn it on, watch myself walk into the kitchen from the light being on. I'm staying right there. These are the sense doors and this movement of the body, I'm staying right there with it. So I go into the kitchen, I stay in there, there's a tray, there's like a counter, and then behind us is the dishwasher. So you put the trays on the counter, I start stacking the little dishes in there, still feel sad, melancholy, feel all the dishes. And then I take the tray and I turn to put it on the dishwasher. And it was as if I was transported in time to a moment when my mother had died and we were all moving her boxes of dishes. Like I think I've told some of you, my mother had an ungodly amount of dishes. Bless her heart. She loved dishes. And she had to have lots of them. She's gone. She doesn't care about these dishes anymore. But we are like, we cannot just throw the dishes away, or we got to figure out, we have to box them with newspaper, and there's all this pressure, and we're all angry and we're all on edge. And there's this deep sadness in the room, and I was the one that people would pack up the box, hand it to me, and I would stick it over on this corner where we had all these boxes that no one knew what we were going to do with. The minute I turned in this yogi job and experienced this, I'm like, oh my God, my mother's showing up in my yogi job. I'm like, you gotta go. you can't hang out here. You gotta go. You have to leave me be here in this moment. But when I realized I'm not in my mother's apartment, I'm here, happy, with the best job ever. I'm not there moving boxes. That is long gone, hasn't happened anymore. That was almost a few, not quite a year from it. Guess what happened to the melancholy next day? It's all gone. Because it's unhooked from my yogi job. I dare say that the moment I moved that very first container in that job and turned, all this memory showed up. And that's what I carried for weeks and weeks and weeks. That is not something the mind can figure out on its own, because it keeps thinking the melancholy or the sadness is connected to this job. So as I try to mentally figure this out, I'm already reinstilling in the mind this this process exists. I'm already telling the mind that what the mind thinks is true. I believe that's why Buddha referred to it as a refuge for the mind and this protector. Because if you are mindful of what's actually happening in your sense doors, in your movements, in your passions, or in those idle discursive thinking, when you're present to that, aware of that, you remember that there is stillness in that, then the mind can unhook itself from things that it has put together. It cannot unhook on its own. It can unhook when there's mindfulness. There's another kind of thing that I noticed that happens more in mindfulness, and you see it through concentration. So imagine something comes up, something that irritates you. It's just something that happens, and there's a little irritation with it, no big deal, just sort of happens. But then what the mind does, the thinking aspect of the mind, brings up all the different times you've been irritated, brings all that up, and you go through this whole dissertation of the nature of irritation. I'm always irritated. This happens, and before you know it, you are in irritation, and you are no longer in the moment. That dissertation is sort of the way a sports TV show happens. So I don't even like sports. And one thing that really bothers me about sports is the commentators that are telling you what's happening as it's happening. So you're looking at the game, and there's somebody that's telling you what happens. But it doesn't just tell you what happens, it fills up all the space. So it tells you all these little tidbits, and there's all this stuff going on, and it's just talking, 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 talking. And I get distracted from the talking, and I can't. It's almost as if I tried once to turn the sound down, see if I would like the game better. It's so boring. It's the same place over and over and over and over. So the commentary, that announcer put some life into it. But you start listening to the announcer more than actually watching the game, or at least with me. I'm listening to the announcer, and if it wasn't for the announcer's energy, I wouldn't have any energy to even pay attention to the game. That's what the mind is doing. You know, something happens, and then the mind starts filling in all this tidbit, goes back, tells you what you think about this, tells you how to feel about that, tells you what's going on here, reminds you of the bigger picture of your life, and it just starts going on and on and on, and we get caught in that. It's what we get caught in, but we're no longer present to whatever it was. So some simple little irritation that really will rise and pass away turns into this long, drawn-out discussion about how my life is one big, giant irritation. Okay, maybe that doesn't happen to you guys. Which brings us to concentration. Concentration is how you stay in that moment. It's how you stay in that moment of time and not fall off and go somewhere else. Concentration, it really doesn't have a lot of different definitions. It's pretty much the ability to focus on one thing, focus on one object. Some teachers I've heard call it one-pointedness. Some teachers call it samadhi. And then some teachers have called it like a gathered or a unified mind. There's this capacity to focus on one thing. Matthew Ricard said that when the mind is full of memories and preoccupations about the future, it misses the freshness of the present moment. In this way, we fail to recognize the luminous simplicity of mind that is always present behind the veil of thought. So when this automatic capacity of the mind to jump off of these sense doors or to jump off these little passions we have or movements in the body, that moment happens and the mind will jump off of that. If we don't pay attention to the jump off, it's just gonna get worse from there. So this paying attention helps us keep from jumping off of the mind and keeps us in the moment. Our ability to hold that moment then is the importance of concentration. So we all know that the mind can get concentrated. Athletes, scientists, artists, I mean, you can talk to people, students, workers, it doesn't matter. We all know that we can get concentrated on something. We can be singularly focused on one thing and stick to that. Our minds can stick to that. We don't have to do that. It is inherent in the mind's capacity to be able to stay focused on one thing. The difficulty we have in life is when we let the mind sort of choose on its own what it's going to be focused on. We kind of let it run amok, and it just kind of stays on one subject that it believes is the most important thing. we take the refuge of mindfulness and the protection that mindfulness can give us to kind of keep us gathered in a much more skillful or non-suffering way. We let the mind run off on its own. And that concentration can get concentrated on things you may not want it to be concentrated on. You can find yourself concentrated in all kinds of obsessive and continuous thinking. I have to sort of set a timer for myself whenever I look at Facebook on my phone. Because at first I didn't even get the whole Facebook thing. And you know, I was one of those kind of people like, I'm not gonna do that. And so I didn't do it. I'm not gonna look at Facebook. But then, you know, my son said, I said, you never call. You know, why do parents always have to chase after their grown kids to talk to them? You know, you never call me anymore. You don't like me, that. He said, I said, I don't know what's happening in your life. He's like, Mama, it's on Facebook. All you have to do is look, you know, everything that's going on. What happened to the telephone? I don't know what happened, but okay. So I get on Facebook, and then, you know, it could get kind of interesting because there's all these people with pictures and stories, and now it's like almost video after video after video, and so you can get lost in this concentrated state of watching and reading Facebook. You are concentrated. The mind is singularly focused on what it is as you go through post after post after post after post after post, and you can sit there for quite a while. We'll just leave it at quite a while. Go further than that. But you can notice when you wake up, look at the clock. It's shocking how long you've been there, sitting there watching and reading over and over and over and over and over. The point of that is to use that to remind yourself that the mind has a natural capacity for concentration. This is not some big thing that we got to figure out, how am I going to get concentrated? It already gets concentrated. The question is, what do we have the mind being concentrated on? Do we just let it get concentrated on whatever it wants? And then for people like me, it's going to always lean towards the negative. It's always going to go towards some degree of complaining. One of the reasons that mind can get concentrated on the things that we don't like, that we don't always think about in terms of our everyday kind of relationship, our everyday practice, is the hindrances. We think of the hindrances when we're sitting down meditating, because when we think about it, when I'm sitting and meditating, that's when I am working on my concentration and my ability to be still, right? I'm working on my concentration, I'm gonna be still, I'm gonna have a calm, tranquil, peaceful mind. Good meditation, that's what happens to us. Good meditation is when we're all peaceful, tranquil. Even though teachers say that's not a good meditation, meditation is just meditation. For most of us in this room, when I've had a peaceful meditation, it's like, oh yes, that was a good meditation. So we then associate that sitting, working up towards concentration as the process by which concentration comes into being. We don't always, and at least when I first started practicing, I didn't ever think of concentration in my everyday kind of walking around, even though we are concentrated most of the day. It's just what we are concentrated on. And we get concentrated, we get sort of distracted into the unskillful, unhelpful types of thinking with the hindrances. We can get very concentrated on trying to get our way in something. Just this constant talking about it in our heads and very concentrated on dreaming on how we're going to make that come into being. How we're going to get this particular thing. What are we going to do about this particular thing? And we can spend half the day going about our day, but our mind is concentrated on our desire. Not on what we're doing, not on the sense gates, not on the body. We don't even notice that we're trapped in some passion. We are concentrated all day on that desire to get something. I gotta have it, need it. When I bought my condo several years ago, there was a moment when I wished I just gave up on the whole thing, just let the whole thing go, because I could not think about anything else. I had all this work piling up. I would be at work, but the entire day was spent thinking about getting a condo. Where would that condo be? What it would look like? Looking on Windermere's website at condos. How much would it cost? What would I do? Should I do this? Should I not do this? I would go into work. My body is present there at work, but my mind is concentrated on this desirous thing that I want. Or the mind can be caught in aversion, and it is off in aversion, dwelling on that over and over and over, irritated, reliving the exact same event over and over and over and over, and reminding ourselves about other events. And no matter what you do, you go through your entire day, you don't even remember the day, because your mind was concentrated on that aversion, that restlessness, worrying, what if, what if, what if. It gets lost in the dullness that's just completely spaced out. Just that capacity for the mind to realize that the mind is capable of being concentrated. What we want to do is remember to have it concentrated on that stillness, that place of stillness. Shantideva said, all other foes I appease and wait upon will show me favors. So all my enemies that I appease and wait upon, they will show me favors. They will give me every aid. But should I serve my dark, defiled emotions, they will only harm me and draw me down to grief. So even though I know those dark, defiled emotions just harm me and bring me down to grief, that's where the mind goes every time. I mean, part of that is because I grew up in trauma, so the mind's always going there. But if I don't pay attention, if I forget or am careless or distracted, then I don't have any way to disrupt that train that's leaving the station. It is totally gone. So then, when some sad moment happens, and the mind begins to bring in all the sadness I've ever experienced, sadness upon sadness upon sadness, remind me of all the sadnesses that I have had for the many years that I have ever had sadness, I get caught in sadness. Of course I get caught in sadness. What else am I going to get caught in? Because that's the only thing the mind is concentrated on, is sadness, 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 sadness. And then you're just stuck in all of that. That dissertation on sadness, you're stuck in it. And because you're stuck in it, the mind cannot hold that sadness. It doesn't like it, and it wants it to go away. So it keeps bringing it to you, and it keeps saying what needs to go away. Keeps bringing it to you, and it keeps saying it needs to go away. It's no wonder we get upset, and we're like all up in a tizzy about this obsessive thinking, because it is just so insatiable. It cannot be satisfied. We want it to go away, and it keeps coming back, keeps coming back, keeps coming back. But when you turn your attention to the actual moment, not the nature of the moment, when you take the extra sentiment out of it and just leave that moment for what it is, then something changes. Something is different. Then you notice that even though something is sad, it's not impossible to hold. Even though something is difficult, it's not impossible to be with. It's just right here. I know exactly what to do. Or even if you don't know what to do, it's not overwhelming in doing anything, because you are not trying to solve a lifetime of difficulty in one moment. You are just trying to deal with this one moment. We won't get there without finding a way to be mindful of the sense doors, to be mindful of when our passions have run amok, to be mindful of when our minds are just off in discursive thinking, or the movement of the body, whatever allows us to come into that moment and take us out of this concentrated effort on the nature of sadness. When I was in law school, teachers would make an important distinction about this one thing. So law school, you don't really have a lot of, you don't have any exams at all. You have one at the end of the semester. You either do it good or you don't. You either pass a class or you don't, because you get one shot. And so the teachers would say, don't tell me everything you know about the law on evidence. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear what you know about evidence. I want you to explain how evidence applies to this problem. But inevitably, when you're sitting there on the exam and you're scared to death, and it's a blue book, so it's all written out, you notice other people are like writing, and I can't think of what to say. What do you think I'm going to think of? Evidence is the nature of the way. It's like we all of a sudden start writing a dissertation on evidence. It's not going to get me anywhere. I'm not going to get that question right. It's not going to help me. But that's what I do, because I am lost in this moment. I don't know what to do. And so I start writing this dissertation on the nature of evidence and evidence law and some law and how evidence law came into be, and this whole discussion that's completely unrelated to what that teacher wants to know. But as you go through law school, and by the time you get to the third year, there's an ability to just be still and wait. And that kind of understanding of the connection between the law and the facts of this question begin to make sense to you. That's what we are working towards. We're working towards taking that moment when the mind just sort of wakes up, this gift that it gives us, it just wakes up and we notice something. We're using that as an opportunity to remember that there is a stillness underneath all of this that's going on. And the only way to get to it is to be still. To look for what is arisen, what hindrance, what distraction, what took me away. What is it that has now come into being? how did it get there? Not analyzing it like I tried to analyze the thinking around my yogi job, but just be still for a moment and sense into it and let the natural inclination of the mind to tell us. This kind of other knowing that we can know just by being still, sort of giving the mind the refuge and the protection that it needs, caring for the mind in that way, giving it this protection that it needs to be able to see the pathway in which that hindrance rose. And then to see the way out of it, see the escape, see the sort of the delusion, the cloudiness of that hindrance, the fogginess of it, so you can get more clarity. But all of that process doesn't have to take a long time, but that is what concentration helps us see. Concentration is what helps us see what's actually happening and not the mind's thinking about what's happening. Because the mind, left to its own devices, will just run into its conditioning and leave it at that. That day of moving my mom's boxes was a big day for me, very difficult. And so the mind, every time I shifted, it's gonna go right there because that's what it's gonna associate with that movement. Unless I get still right here, this moment, and notice what conditioning is being attached. That sort of conditioning aspect that the mind runs to as soon as it gets connected to some sense, some sensory thing, is how the ego comes into play. And Pema Chodron wrote this great quote about the ego. She said, the ego is like a room of your own. She has a way with words, so. Ego is like a room of your own. It's a room with a view, with the temperature and the smells and the music that you like. You want it your own way. You just like to have a little peace. You just like to have a little happiness. You know, just give me a break in my room. But the more you think that way, the more you try to get your life to come out so that it's always like your room. The more you fear other people and what's outside your room grows. And then rather than becoming more relaxed, you start pulling down the shades, locking the doors, and when you go out, you would find that your experience outside more and more is uncomfortable. Right? So you find that all of a sudden the only place that's comfortable is in your room when things go your way. And the outside world gets more and more and more comfortable. That is the nature of that ego. That is the nature of conditioning. And that conditioning is where the mind is going to go in concentration, if we don't begin to bring the refuge of mindfulness and protection that comes from mindfulness, so that the mind in its concentration can be concentrated towards this very moment and not our whole life at one time. Here's my Milarepa quote. I'll save that for later. I'll say something from Jack Kornfield. What he said is that we need a repeated discipline, a genuine training in order to let go of our old habits of mind and to find and sustain a new way of seeing. It will not come on its own like that. I think that is the nature of this training, of this practice, of why we consider this a journey and a continuous practice, is because no amount of wanting the mind not to be caught in its habitual patterns will stop it from being caught in its habitual patterns. That even though the mind, from everything I've learned about this, these five faculties, it's clear that the mind has the ability to awaken on its own. But we kind of leave it out in the weeds. You know, we kind of forget to get the weeds out of the garden. We kind of leave it to run amok. There was a commercial once, years ago, was striking to me. It was a commercial, I think this commercial was about global warming, but I can't remember now what the commercial was about. It was the commercial that was so moving. And some of you guys may have seen it, I don't know. But it was children, little kids, like some toddlers and some 5-year-olds, 7-year-olds, all the way up to maybe about 15, I think, or 12, or somewhere around in there, preteens. They would have these kids standing in situations where there should be adults there. So you would have these kids standing or being at a construction site with hammers, supposed to put the building up, but they don't have a clue how to put the building up, right? There would be these children standing in grocery stores, supposedly running the grocery stores, and they wouldn't have a clue how to do it. They would be running around, playing. And you could see that there was all the stuff that needed to be done, and it's like on an assembly line, and all the products and stuff would be just rolling off the assembly line, and the kids were playing and doing all this other stuff. Like, somebody should be taking care of that, but they wouldn't think of it that way. And every time I think about this kind of untamed, undisciplined mind, that's what I think of. I imagine that I am letting my 2-year-old run my life. I'm letting all these kids who don't have a clue how to do this run everything, because I'm not a kid anymore. I'm an adult. I have all this capacity as an adult, but I have to sort of let my adult self come forward. I have to be here in 2015 and not lost in some conditioning that may have come from some moment in time when I was a kid. When I let the mind get careless, let it get forgetful and distracted, that's sort of what it's like. It's letting the conditioning aspect of us run everything. And most of these kids that exist in us, they haven't any idea how to do this life. It's way too complicated. And so it's remembering to show up, to be there when the mind wakes up. When the mind wakes up, not letting that moment in time go. Use it to your advantage. So I thought I'd give you a couple of ideas of how to practice this, because part of the difficulty is that you can know a lot of this, But in the moment that you really need to remember and wake up and hold it, you may not be able to if you don't practice on much easier things. So, some ways. These are the ways I practice. Take a piece of fruit, take something. Before you eat it, look at it. Get a good look at it. Decide, what is this? What is it going to taste like? You know what it tastes like. You had an orange forever. You know what the mind knows what an orange tastes like. So it's going to tell you what that orange is going to taste like, what it's going to feel like. It's going to tell you the whole story about the orange. And just notice that that's what it's doing as you look at this orange. And then stay with yourself peeling it and eating it and see if that really is what an orange is. Because the mind's view of an orange and the actual orange you're eating, very different. You can begin to see that. It's very simple, but you're kind of like training the mind that there's a difference between this talking about and this experiencing. Or, let's say first thing in the morning, you get up, you get your slippers on, you go into the kitchen, you flip the switch, and you go over to the coffee pot and you fix the coffee. Okay. Before you turn that light switch on, notice what you think about what you're about to do. And then actually feel into turning the light switch on in the kitchen, going over, getting the coffee pot, putting the water in, pouring it in. Listen to that sound. Listen to the feel, the sensation of that movement, and pay attention. You can begin to see how that conditioning rises up in your life. You don't have to be sitting necessarily on a cushion to figure this out. You don't have to be at a retreat. But you do have to be willing to take some moment in time, and before you just do it, just stop for a minute and think about what your mind thinks about this. See if you can't see what it feels like every morning to make the coffee. How much of your making the coffee is about the coffee, and how much of it is about all the thoughts you have first thing in the morning? Here's my Milarepa quote. I'll leave you with this. Veiled by ignorance, the minds of man and Buddha appear to be different. Yet in the realm of the essence of mind, they are both one of one taste. So when we're in the realm of mind, our minds is the same taste as Buddha's mind. I'll leave you with that. So let's sit a moment. Next week, we'll do the last faculty, which is wisdom, and I will tie how the five all interrelate with each other. Oh, yes, ma'am.
When you were given the example about your remembering about your mother's dishes.
Mm-hmm.
recognizing the cause of it as being able to release repetitive thinking?
Well, I guess it sounds like you're saying like there's some sadness in the body about those dishes. Clearly that's there. The thing, it may very well be, and it may come up at some point, but that sadness is not related to the yogi job. That's the problem. The mind made that connection between the two. And so then I think my yogi job is a sad thing. So whether or not that sadness has to be experienced, to tell you the truth, I don't know. I don't know if it needs to be experienced like that. I mean, I could probably, we all have, I'm sorry, her question was whether or not the experience with my yogi job, that sadness, whether the point was just that the mind disconnected the two, or is it that I needed to experience that sadness? Is that what it, that the two distinctions?
Recognizing the cause of the sadness versus some other way of experiencing it and releasing it through that.
Right, so whether or not I recognize just the cause of that sadness, or whether or not there's a need to experience it and release it. And I guess, I don't really know. I don't know if most of our memories, because they're memories, have any point anymore anyway. I mean, if you think about it, the sadness around my mother's death only had relevance when she died, and then it was there. Everything else is the mind's connecting this moment in time to some present moment. Now, I'm not saying that I wouldn't experience that sadness in some respects. But what I'm saying is that sadness connected to the dishes in that retreat is a mind construct. It's not real sadness. I hope that makes sense, because it's hard when we talk about grieving type situations to think that grief could not be real. I mean, she's gone, of course I'd be sad. But what I mean is that the only reason that sadness even existed is because the mind took a memory that it had in its own sort of file cabinet. And with that memory, there was sadness because it was sad at that time. But that was then. And then it applied that memory with all its constructs, the whole experience, to this present moment. But this present moment is not related to that sadness at all. And that uncoupling of that mental construct together lets the memory be a memory, which is all it is, and it lets this present moment be the best yogi job in the world, because the two are not together anymore. We don't know how much, well, everything that we do in life is coupled together in the mind into some things. We don't know what it's coupled together. So it's very hard to just say, oh, I have this experience and I'm experiencing this sadness, without uncoupling the two. Because this is the woo-woo part. You take the story, the thinking, off any emotion, and that emotion will not stay very long. So I don't know what it is. I mean, there's some emotional energy there, but it just becomes sensation unless you couple it with some story, and then the story and everything's all mixed up together, and then it's like, oh, I'm sad, or, you know, I'm hurt, or some emotion. You take the story out and you try to just hold that energy for that emotion, It's going to be a hard thing to hold because it doesn't stay. All of a sudden it becomes, okay, it's a lot of tingling, a lot of movement in the body and things like that. But you keep wanting to grab a story. So this sensation in the body will make sense. And so from that standpoint, you could stretch it out there into the cosmos that there is no emotional energy that we have to release out of the body. There are memories that we have to let go of. They don't exist anymore. And if it's in this very moment, we can hold that. See the difference? So I think that's what I think in relation to it, having worked with so much emotional difficulty, that's the way I find that I am less and less and less believing in the existence of some emotional energy that I have to work to. There are many, many memories I have to let go of. But once I do, once I let it be a memory and not something that's happening right now, then I'm free of it. So I don't want to make it sound like it's, you know, all easy, easy. I have done a lot of work around it, but if you just put that effort in, that's what ultimately happens, I think. I probably should check to see if there's announcements.